I always tell people, don't post your life. Don't live your life online. Live your life in the world. The criminals are out there watching. They're watching Facebook and the Nextdoor app and LinkedIn. And you go on vacation and you're posting all over the place, not from your home. That may make your home a target. You wouldn't walk up to a crosswalk in a street and just step out. You look both ways. You look left, you look right, you look left, you look right, and then you go. Not having multi-factor authentication today is running out in the middle of an 8-lane highway with your eyes closed and your arms up in the air. You're just asking to get hit.
This is the Cybercrime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be.
In my experience, it only takes hearing what these attacks are like a few times to realize you need to prepare yourself for what could be a business-ending experience.
That's Andy Anderson, the founder and CEO of DataStream Insurance. For over a decade, Andy has been working with victims of cybercrime. He's seen firsthand the human impact of a cyber attack. Now, he's on a mission to shed light on the threats we all face from a world we can't see. Today, Andy has invited Michael O'Hara to the Cybercrime Lab. Michael is a certified information system security professional who enjoys spreading the word about cybersecurity. In today's episode, he shares a few stories of his experiences in the cybersecurity world. How one client mistakenly paid $30,000 on an invoice to a threat actor, and another was targeted for 6 weeks in a row.
Michael, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast. For those who don't know you, I'd love if you'd take, 30 seconds and just introduce yourself.
I certainly will, but first I want to say I was promised that there'd be a free lunch yet. The only one I saw eating here was you, Andy. So,
It's in the green room, only in the green room. You're not in the green room.
I guess I don't rate. All right. Anyhow, my name is Michael O'Hara, and I am a CISSP. For those of you that don't know what that is, it's a Certified Information System Security Professional. And I have been doing cybersecurity for onwards of 30 years now. I am also a certified HIPAA professional. I am a certified security compliance specialist and a certified cybersecurity architect. A friend of mine who was introducing me last summer at a Channel Pro magazine event said, "Here's my friend Mike. He has more letters after his name than he has in his name." All those acronyms just mean one thing, Andy. I am a really sick individual who actually enjoys spreading the word about cybersecurity and cyber hygiene. My actual title is that I'm a cybersecurity evangelist, which means just what it sounds like. I travel to companies, I travel to conferences, any place where there's an audience like your podcast, Andy, where I can speak about good cyber hygiene and how you can actually leverage that to keep your environment safe and secure from all of the hundreds of millions of vulnerabilities that plague us every day on the internet.
I love it. That's why we kicked off this podcast, particularly for kind of your everyday business owner, business manager, some IT folks as well. So many people, they sort of know that these threats exist and, this is something that could happen, but so much of it is in the shadows and the real stories never make it to the light of day or to press that they're reading. And so, we wanted to have folks like you on who've lived through events, who've helped organizations prepare for these and stop these type of situations, what it's really like. So excited to have you on and excited to have you share some of those experiences and stories. Let's kick it off. What's some of the sort of more interesting or frightening events that you've been involved with, stories that you want to share?
Let's start with something I like to call the parable of the 30-cent phone call. And I say 30-cent phone call because average cost of a cell phone call these days is about 30 cents, right? So there was a company, and because I know we never want to use names, places, dates, times, anything. What's that old TV show, Dragnet? The names and events have been changed to protect the guilty, right? So let's say this is Irving's Boatyard in San Diego, California. And Irving's got a pretty good business, about $1.5 million, $2 million a year in revenues, a staff of about 8 people. And Irving has Gloria, who has been his administrative assistant since he opened the boatyard. And Irving works, man. He never, ever takes a break, right? So work-driven was Irving that after 38 years of marriage, at 63 years old, it cost him his marriage. His wife said enough, and she left. But that's okay, because at 64, Irving found himself a new wife, a new love, who was 44. And one day, Irving came into the office, and he announced to Gloria and everybody else, you know, my new wife, I'm not going to make the same mistakes with her that I made with my first wife. Therefore, she wants to take a Caribbean cruise, and I'm going to take my first vacation ever, and I'm going to take her on a Caribbean cruise. And that was great, right? Isn't that great? He's a nice guy, wants to do right by his new wife. Well,
new mistakes.
He takes the cruise. Well, the mistakes are about to happen. He takes the cruise. And the first day he's out on the cruise, Gloria receives a really official looking email from a vendor, and the name of the vendor sounds legitimate. And the email says, to Irving, please find attached the invoice and wiring instructions to pay this outstanding $30,000 invoice. Now, here's why I call it the parable of the 30-cent phone call. The folks in the office, Gloria and her two office staff, actually sat and debated for about 15 minutes. Does this look real? I don't know if this looks real. I think it looks real, but do you think it looks real? Maybe we should call Irving. I don't know. Irving is on his first vacation in, you know, 38 years. Let's not bother Irving. Let's just pay it. And they took the wiring instructions and they wired $30,000 to this account offshore. And when they came home, you know, Irving went into the office and the staff said, oh, we didn't want to bother you for anything. We even took care of this $30,000 invoice. And Irving had a fit because Irving didn't recognize the company. Irving didn't recognize the amount. Irving never incurred the $30,000 bill that they had paid. So this is how I got involved in the story. Irving then called his bank and started demanding that they do something to make him whole again. And basically, the chief operating officer of the bank, who I know very well, told him there's no remedy for stupid. That was the exact quote. By the way, that was a quote. There is no remedy for stupid. But what we will do is we will pay for you to work with Michael O'Hara for about 2 weeks and let him come in and, you know, at least do some training and a basic review of your cyber habits. When I got to Irving's Boatyard, I found out a couple of things. I found out that Irving really, really likes, you know, bagels and lox first thing in the morning, because every morning he would offer it to me. And I also found out that he had never once considered cybersecurity at all, even though he was doing a lot of work on the internet now. He was selling boat parts and everything else, right? He had never considered cybersecurity or cyber hygiene. Upon review, it got worse, by the way, upon review of just some of their practices, they were taking credit card numbers on their website. Want to take a guess, Andy?
Oh, wow.
A regular submission form, clear text, and this was only 3 years ago. So when they asked me, you know, Michael, what could we have done? How could we have stopped this situation? The first thing that I said to the client, to Irving's Boatyard, was you need to educate your staff on frauds and scams. So there's a couple of ways that you can do this. There are services that you can sign up for that will help you, you know, educate your staff. And I don't know if we're allowed to, you know, mention products or not. One of the ones that I happen to like a lot is KnowB4, KNOW B4. They not only help inform your company, they'll also provide testing to your company to see who clicks on, you know, erroneous emails. So I told them, you know, the first thing is to educate your staff, and it can't be at one time set it and forget it. Here, take this training, and then nobody ever takes the training again. You have to set up training and go through it at least once a year with your staff and talk about these things. When they come up in the news, talk about them in the office.
Never underestimate the power of having staff who understand cybersecurity. When your people know what they're looking for, there's a better chance that they'll detect a threat before it does major damage. Time is of the essence when it comes to these attacks. The earlier you notice something fishy, the sooner you can get off the hook.
Now, I took Gloria aside and I asked her, I said, I understand there was a little bit of debate in the office about whether or not to pay this invoice. Can you tell me what ultimately made you want to pay it? And she explained to me that the logo on the email looked legitimate. And even though they couldn't find or cross-reference it in their books, it looked legitimate and they had all of, you know, Irving's information. So I sat down and gave Gloria and her team some special advice, which is from now on, whenever you get an email, and this is advice to your listeners as well, Andy, whenever you get an email, if you're even mildly suspicious of the email, even in Gmail, Gmail, Outlook, you can go into View Properties or View Header, and then you can read the header information. And it might say, and you know this, Andy, right? Because the other thing she said to me was, and it came from a legitimate email address. Well, when we looked at the from email address, sure enough, it looked quasi-legitimate. But when we dug into the header of the email, we saw that it was from an email server in Russia. And, you know, while I don't expect everybody to get that technical into the weeds, here's the clue. The name of the company that the invoice came from was, let's say, at Delaware.com. And at Delaware.com was a legitimate email address. Delaware, because you know, that's where a lot of companies are incorporated, right? At Delaware.com. This email was at Delaware, no E at the end, .com. So on quick glance, it looks like a legitimate email address. When you really analyze that, it was an illegitimate email, which means it was an illegitimate request, and Gloria could have saved her boss $30,000. Now, here is the happy ending to this story. Irving fully realized that this was Gloria's ball that was dropped. And after we trained Gloria, Irving turned around and said to me, what am I going to do? She's been with me forever. She's been the best employee I ever had. This was the first mistake I can recall that she's ever made. And she kept her job, which, you know, is pretty good in these days.
I love that story, right? We talk with folks on this and in our sort of day-to-day business. You know, it's a decent business, right? But it's not a big business, right? And small businesses are hit with the majority of cyber attacks, right? Like more than 50% of small businesses and even the smallest. And even the fact pattern, you don't know how, I mean, $30,000 is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money. I mean, you see ransomware incidents running up into the millions, but this sort of everyday, you know, fraudulent transfer, business email compromise, right? This would be sort of categorized under both of those, is always sort of running neck and neck in terms of the number of incidents that happen. It doesn't quite make the newspaper and the headlines as much because, again, like $30,000 is, and even stuff, I mean, we've heard of incidents 10 times as big that didn't make the newspaper. And they're not newsworthy, probably, but they obviously impact these businesses. Who knows how sort of involved this threat actor was? You know, there's a couple of things that, as you described this incident, did they know Irving was on vacation? Did they know, you know, maybe even where he had gone or one of the suppliers that he works with, right? Like when we see these, when they're done really, really well, you realize how much stuff is out, social media, on your website. It's pretty easy to follow some of this stuff, right? If he has any sort of public social media, he says, oh, I'm on vacation, right? Or like, you know, pictures from blah, blah, blah. And so suddenly they know. We've seen it ourselves, literally, like new employees start, they'll get, you know, what purports to be an email from me saying, oh, can you go buy some like Amazon gift cards or like Google gift cards? We've literally had an employee was like, I literally was talking to him and he's like, oh, I'm checking out of Costco with those gift cards that you asked for. And I was like, I didn't ask for any gift cards. And that was like $20, right? I mean, it was like hundreds of dollars, but clearly they're like watching, LinkedIn and seeing when things get updated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if Irving had posted any place or not, but as a good rule of thumb, general rule of thumb, I always tell people, don't post your life. Don't live your life online. Live your life in the world. And if you are going on a fabulous vacation to Wildwood, New Jersey, my favorite beach town in the world, right? If you're going on a fabulous vacation, post those pictures when you get home, if you absolutely have to. Don't post them in real time. Crime statistics have shown, Andy, that it's not just cyber crime. It's real life crime as well. The criminals are out there watching, and they're watching Facebook and the Nextdoor app and LinkedIn. And you go on vacation and you're posting all over the place, not from your home. That may make your home a target. If you're posting, if you're Irving and you're posting, hey, finally taking, you know, my new wife on that vacation, first one in 38 years, it may make it attractive for someone to realize that there's an opening and that your defenses are softened. And let's go in and try to take advantage of the situation. But, you know, you talked a moment ago about monetary costs, and maybe $30,000 is a lot. Maybe it's not a lot. But I also come down to reputational costs. We changed Irving's name, state, and business for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is we don't want Irving's business to suffer a reputational cost. We don't want reputational damage because people who do business with you, if they find out you've been breached, might look at you a little differently and factor that in their choice as to whether or not to do business with you going forward. Now, you know, it also comes down to how well you're protecting yourself. Another business I'm thinking of, a large warehouse in any town, USA, 100 employees. I was brought in to help them again. This was after the fact. And what had happened was they started suffering real reputational costs because 6 weeks in a row, Andy, 6 weeks in a row, their staff had been targeted. They had Google Works for their back end, and their staff had been targeted 6 weeks in a row. One person every week was hijacked for their email account. And it was that old chestnut where the threat actor goes in, hijacks your email account, and then creates a rule, an inbox rule, that says if anybody emails back into this account, just delete it. And that's so you don't know as the person who's been compromised that you've been compromised. And then what the threat actor did was start sending out a spam to all the customers of this warehouse, asking them to click a link that would take them to a nefarious site looking for personally identifiable information. And after the sixth week that this happened, they finally thought, maybe we better look at this a little closer. And they went to their IT person, who was, you know, an MSP, and said, why does this keep happening to us? And the MSP said to them, well, it keeps happening because when I first took over supporting you 10 weeks ago, I told you you had to turn on multi-factor authentication for all your email accounts. And your answer to me was, that's too many steps to get into our email. We don't want to do it.
While multi-factor authentication, or MFA, may seem like a hassle, believe us when we say it's worth the extra few steps it would take to log into your email. It's a simple yet effective way of keeping at bay a large portion of threat actors. If a cyber criminal can get into your email, there's no telling what kind of havoc they can wreak.
So after the fact, I was hired and I went in to write them a WISP. And for those of you who don't know, a WISP is a written information security program. And the owner of the company asked me about this and said, do we really need the multi-factor authentication like our IT person says we need? And my answer was, it's 2020. When I wake up in the morning and my wife says, I love you, I make her show me a fingerprint and her driver's license. I want multi-factors of authentication for everything. And this company suffered a real reputational hit because then they had to turn around to their clients who had gotten these emails and explain to them, not just why did this happen once, why did it happen 6 weeks in a row?
Yeah.
Why didn't you close the barn door?
Well, from several different angles. From a legal perspective, you think about the liability, and cyber attacks happen to lots of organizations across the security spectrum. Obviously, there are things that can reduce it, but even if you have good security controls, you can still suffer a significant event. But if it's happening over and over and over and again, your reputation is damaged, but also, you know, the potential liability should one of those customers be impacted, and then you essentially have to represent in court or in some sort of court case, hey, what did we do here? And if you're not even doing the basics, you're doing it not only what someone told you you needed to do, but then this happened to you six times in a row. It's sort of like, what sort of case do you have in front of that judge and jury? Because it's like, fool me once, fool me twice, fool me. What do you say on the sixth time?
Well, what's the definition of insanity, Andy? Touching the hot stove over and over and over and expecting a different result.
Yeah. You know better than me, like particularly for MFA, obviously massively improvement in terms of the reduction in events. But also there's some newer technology that can really reduce the number of times that you have to, yes, or you're going to have to put in the code once a week or once every couple of days or whatnot. But that's also putting in the right technology, using the device, using the fingerprint, using some of these other things that create much less user friction.
There is, but there's also become a sophistication with the user where they're starting to understand now that they have to take steps to protect themselves. I often use this metaphor when I'm speaking publicly. You wouldn't walk up to a crosswalk in a street and just step out. You look both ways. You look left, you look right, you look left, you look right, and then you go.
Yep.
Not having multi-factor authentication today is running out in the middle of an 8-lane highway with your eyes closed and your arms up in the air. You're just asking to get hit. But you were talking about the insurance industry before, and I know that's near and dear to everybody's heart here. We just went through one the other day, and I had a client who called me up, and they had their yearly form, Andy. My insurance carrier just sent me this form. And they called me and asked me if I could help them fill out the form. Because as you know, they're getting more robust. 5 years ago, what was it? 4 or 5 questions. And now it could be 10 pages, right?
Not always, but yeah. And you think it's bad if you haven't had an incident, wait until you have had an incident when everyone that you work with is going to say, do you have coverage? And your board is going to be asking for it and all of these things. Those forms are particularly not fun.
Well, that's great to answer them and say, yes, we have coverage. But here's the point of me bringing up those forms. The client said to me, I'll make up a question. All hard drives are 256-bit AES encrypted. Yes or no? Yes, no, not applicable. And I said, just for fun, I said, well, what do you think the answer is? And he said, well, it sounds really important. I said, okay. So it sounds like we should answer yes. And I had to say to the client, let's stop for a second. It sounds like we should answer yes is probably a good knee-jerk reaction. But the point is, do you know that the answer is yes? And he said, I'm not sure. I said, who would have this information? And he said, well, my MSP does all of our PCs and servers. And I said, great, let's get the MSP on the line. And I went through it with the MSP and I said, okay, now, is this a true statement? Are all hard drives 256-bit AES encrypted? And the guy said, well, hold on a second, let me run a report. He came back, he said, all of the laptops are hard drive encrypted. Great. What about the desktops? None of the desktops are. I said to the person filling out the form, because even if you hire someone like me to fill out the form, you're still responsible for filling out the form, right? The business. So I said to the person, let's look at how you need to answer this, because your answer needs to be nuanced now. And how I would answer this would be, a percentage of our hard drives are AES 256-bit encrypted, and that percentage is 60, and that belongs to all of the mobile workstations and laptops that we have. However, our desktops and servers are not 256-bit encrypted, but we have created a program to start the process of encrypting those hard drives. And I explained to the client, the reason you need to word it like that is you need to show that you're doing something. You have awareness of the threat, and you're taking positive steps towards filling in the gap or remediating the threat, mitigating the risk. And he said, what would have happened if I just said yes? I said, that's great. If you just said yes, and you got into the position of needing to make a claim on your cyber insurance, and it came to light that you just answered yes, and the devices affected were indeed not encrypted, the insurance company now has grounds to not pay your claim.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and goes, they can do that? I'm like, of course they can do that.
Yeah. You're getting into the world that I deal with in my day job most of the time, but it's two audiences that are sort of talking different languages and I think really not understanding each other particularly well. And we see this, an underwriter is trying to make a simple decision tree and try and put yes, no questions on top of systems that really don't fit well into yes, no frameworks. The all question being particularly problematic because I'll see even worse ones that are sort of like, are all devices have some sort of endpoint detection and remediation monitoring? And you're like, all devices, how are we defining devices? Is that mobile devices? I mean, even beyond that, like, is that my Internet of Things? I mean, a lot of stuff is devices. So it creates all kinds of problems. For the most part, I think clients do exactly what you're describing, which is try and answer it honestly, some even with a lot more care, but there's not even an option to provide it depends or I'll explain. And I think what you see, unfortunately, is often the client is filling it out, even sometimes their agent who's helping them is equally sort of not really an expert in cyber and doesn't understand the detail of what they're answering here. And then, of course, the underwriter has to take things at face value. They have to take this is the truth. And literally, like, the individual has attested to it. And so then, yeah, you get into a really sticky situation, which is why we always recommend folks work with an expert, really understand what you're answering. And we even go one step further and say, can you provide some documentation to prove that? And then we keep that in a file and sometimes send it along with the application. So then you put yourself in a really good place to make a case that you believed it.
And that's what I advise, to provide a body of evidence along with it. Even if there's not a space on the form to write your nuanced response, type it up and attach it and send it. And ensure that you have a receipt for it. And that's the whole way to try to self-mitigate the risk. And you're right, because the only other answer here would be for these underwriters to start conducting security risk assessments against their clients themselves. And man, you want to see insurance rates go through the roof, because that's not an inexpensive proposition.
Right now, you're essentially putting humans in the middle of this translation of trying to understand a complex network computer system and interpret it by humans, often who aren't experts, and simplify that into legalese and one step away from paper and PDFs, only then to plug it back into another computer system where you're going to interpret it again with risk models and whatnot. And that just seems sort of crazy. Why are you putting a human in the middle here? What some of the folks like us are building is essentially a computer to computer connection, and then the ability to pull data, much more rigorous data, much larger, much more subtle. All the nuance and complexity can be interpreted essentially directly from the data. Now, that's not here yet, but that's the future that is coming. And the people who are really pushing cyber, and I think there's benefits, obviously, in making the insurance applications much simpler. But let's be honest about the state of cyber risk and cybersecurity and how early we are in really understanding that world. And I think the thing that got me excited to get into the cyber insurance space was the potential for insurance and the data that it often creates and the analysis of risk that it brings to really inform that the whole process of creating safer systems and the whole understanding of what is really driving down, what drives down risk, what drives down the losses here in a detail and a complexity that only machine to machine will we truly be able to understand.
So I'm going to leave you with the story of the ransomware attack turned extortion perpetuated by the inside threat. a lot of us don't remember the days of the Blue Dot Money Card exploit. Some of us do. And this was back early ransomware attack. It would put up a blue screen on your machine with a bad FBI logo and say, if you want to get rid of the screen, go to Walmart, buy a Blue Dot Money Card, come back and give us the number. Well, this is still out there. People don't realize it because it doesn't hit a lot anymore. But about a year ago, a client that I'm aware of got hit with this. And their IT guy came in and said, this is nothing, and got rid of it. However, one of the employees who knew about this went out to Gmail and registered an account anonymous, and then started sending emails to the owner of the company saying, I know you've tried to thwart my attempt. So an inside threat actor knew that this had happened with this money wall hack, and then set up this Gmail account and started emailing the owner of the company, basically saying, I am the hacker, and I know you tried to thwart my attempts to collect money from you. And using inside information that he had, he knew the owner of the company was sleeping with his secretary, said, I know that you're sleeping with Carol, and if you do not pay me via Western Union, I think he asked for like $2,500.
Might as well go a little bigger, right?
He asked for $2,500. I am going to release on the internet the pictures I have of you and Carol going in and out of a motel.
Wow.
And the owner thought that this reeked terribly of, you know, something going on. He actually went out and hired a private investigator to look into this, because he went to the IT guy and said, is this possible? And the IT guy said, no, with the hack that you got hit with, it didn't exfiltrate any data. I don't know what's going on here. And it was actually the private investigator that tracked this guy down, because wrote back and said, we can't Western Union you the money. This is one of my favorite stories, Andy. We cannot Western Union you the money. And said, we'll leave the $2,500 in a brown paper bag at the garbage at a Burger King. Now, I don't think anybody listening to your cast right now has any delusion of what happened next. This idiot went to pick up the $2,500 and was immediately arrested, except he wasn't. He sent his idiot kid brother to go pick up the $2,500. Who was immediately arrested. And as soon as the cops, from what I understand, as soon as the cops got this kid, you know, and he started saying, it wasn't me, it was my brother. And he's the shipping manager at the company. The moral of that story is threats come from any place. It could be your own inside people. You have to train people not only on what the threats could be, but what on the consequences are. So here is a place where they clearly did not have in their employee handbook, if you try to extort the owner, you're going to jail.
I don't think you need to put that in a handbook. I don't think anyone's really going to question, you know, oh, why'd that guy get fired, right?
You know, Andy, my exact thought was yours when I heard it was $2,500. I actually said to the person telling me this, I said, you mean 25,000? And he said, no, 2,500.
At least at one, if not two zeros, right?
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Oh, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cyber Crime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from Datastream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe. More importantly, stay ready.